Week 7 is done. It was unusual. It was unique. It was one for the football connoisseurs out there. The Vikings finally fall. The weirdest Sunday night game anyone's ever seen. Kickers forgot how to kick. And the game of the year happened, but not many people saw it. All that and much more this week in the MMQB 10 Things podcast.
The MMQB presents the MMQB 10 Things podcast, powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your hosts, Andy Benoit and Gary Gramling.
Hello and welcome to the MMQB 10 Things podcast. I am Gary Gramling. I am here with Andy Benoit. Week 7 is done. It was weird. It was wild. It was unusual, unique. It was ugly. It was beautiful. It was all things, Andy. This was kind of an unforgettable day.
Yeah, because I watched all four windows. I started with the very early game and went all the way to the late one, and everything. It's probably as long as a day could possibly be, actually, isn't it, on a Sunday? Because it started at 7:30 Eastern, and then you had an overtime end in a tie.
Yeah, it was a marathon day, and it was up and down. There was, we'll get into it later. I thought the game of the year happened in the 4:30 window, and nobody saw it because everyone was watching the Patriots Steelers. I'm not going to call it a crap fest, but it wasn't a very good game.
Don't do that. That was a good game.
No, it was not as good as the one that I watched. But let's jump into. We got to start with the Sunday nighter.
Number one,
the Sunday night game where kickers couldn't kick and no one could move the ball forward. It was a game for the connoisseurs. Lots of defense, no offense. I can't remember a game like this anytime in recent memory, and the way it ended was just, well, it was unbelievable.
I love the game, because when you get these kind of games, for one, a lot of the low-scoring games in NFL history have had like a inclement weather as a factor, or backups were in, or something. Like the last 3-0 game I saw, they pointed out during the telecast, were the Jets and the Cardinals in 2012. I believe that was the Ryan Lindley game. I might be mistaken, but I think that was when Arizona was down to Ryan Lindley and they were playing. I think you and I got reps in that game at quarterback for him, Gary. This wasn't like that, though. Everybody had their players. It was perfect conditions. It's in a controlled environment on prime time, and it was just two teams punching each other in the mouth play after play, and everything gets heightened then. Every first down becomes more important. The chance of points becomes enthralling, just a mere chance of it. The emptiness of points when the field goals don't go in. This was by far the most excited and pleasurable I've been watching football this season for a single game.
It was, I audibly gasped when Richard Sherman hit Larry Fitzgerald on that one play. And that was such a stereotypical play for this game where everyone was just hammering each other. And it was like, guys, you're such nice, respected guys in the league. Be gentle with each other. No one get hurt.
Well,
here.
They're playing football at that point. The guy who really needs to get that memo, because the only one who was doing that a little bit after, and it could have been a big deal in the game, was Sherman's cornerback one slot over to him, Jeremy Lane. He has to toe the line a little tighter next time. That could have cost him. He had a few hits late.
Well, he probably should have cost him at the end of the first half there. That I mean, he picked up that penalty, and they bailed him out by calling it offsetting because, you know, whatever.
Which I didn't mind either. I guess, Terry McCauley doesn't mess around either, does he? The referee in this game, it's right, it's prompt, it's correct, it's to the point, we're moving on, halftime, here we go.
I made the terrible mistake of remarking to my wife when it was about midway through the third quarter, I was like, this game's going at a pretty good clip. I think we're going to start taping early tonight. I actually said that out loud. And I was what can go wrong?
That's what it did.
Can't be worse than last week. But I don't know. If you missed it, if you fell asleep, if you just turned it off in disgust because it was ruining your fantasy game or whatever it would be, you had two missed chip shot field goals in overtime. And this game ended 6-6. And if you despise special teams, this was one for you. The Chandler Catanzaro miss at the end. I mean, it was such a, you know, David Johnson, it looked like he was over the pylon. They put it on the 6-inch line. They try to punch it in, and Seattle stands him up, which was, it was an awesome stand. Cardinals come back out, pick up the lay of game, and then the kick, it was like hand of God came down and just whacked the thing right back onto the field.
Yeah.
It hit so square on the upright. It was vicious. It was cruel the way it bounced back onto the field. And that's just the way it's gone for the Cardinals this year.
Well, two things on that play. Two of Seattle's best players got involved on that. Bobby Wagner and Richard Sherman,
yep,
factored in on the line of vision. And then the other thing, and maybe we'll hear about it during the week, and it's going to be second guessing now, but they went hurry up right after that David Johnson play. They rushed to the line and tried to catch,
yes,
Seattle off guard when I believe everything's reviewable upstairs, right? And,
yes,
in overtime.
That is correct.
Bruce Arians is going to be second-guessed for that, because it looked to me, on the naked eye, it looked like he didn't get in. And then when I saw the replay, I thought, okay, that was a touchdown, that the ball was on the goal line, and the goal line's the plane. So I think that you could say it's a mistake now. They wanted to catch Seattle off guard. Other teams have done that before with great success. New England did it today against Pittsburgh. But that's what's going to happen. It's the nature of these primetime games and being a head coach. Bruce Arians will get second-guessed for that one.
Yeah, not too much, though. Yeah, when they rushed back to the line, I was wondering if maybe they thought there was a fumble over the pylon because that ball came out at the very end. There was not, but I'm wondering if that was maybe a concern for them. Oh, boy. But, yeah, this game was something. Bobby Wagner blocked a field goal with his armpit earlier in the game, and certainly that played a role in what went on late. And there's something with that turf. I mean, you know, Hauschka took up, took about a freaking crater on that first field goal he kicked. There's something going on because they do that weird, they bring it outside to grow it and maintain it, and then they move it back into the stadium for the games.
Right.
It's not right. It's not the way grass is meant to be grown.
Two things, I know we got to move on here. Two things just as something to move forward with and think about if you're a Seattle fan. One is Russell Wilson's not moving around this year, and I don't know if the injuries are the reason why. I think he's been a better quarterback because of it, and I think it's going to pay off late in the season. And then two is Earl Thomas has played more of the strong safety position, really, because they're diversifying their coverages on that side of the ball. And it's been fun to watch. I think he's a better player down near the box. So two probably the most important guy on offense and defense playing very different styles of football this year for Seattle there.
Well, the tie on Sunday night, let's go into topic two.
Number two.
The Vikings lose, so the Dolphins can drink their champagne, the 72 Dolphins, whatever they do to celebrate. No more undefeated teams in the NFL in 2016. The Vikings go down, and they go down hard. Sam Bradford's return to Philadelphia goes pretty much how Sam Bradford's entire tenure in Philadelphia went. This was a game where the Vikings' offensive line was overwhelmed.
They were. They've got a problem there in Minnesota, too. It's been that way all season long. When T.J. Clemmings first came in at left tackle after Matt Khalil got hurt, this was in the Carolina game, I put on that film and I thought, you know, he's using his hands better. There's more of an assertiveness to him this year. That's commendable because he's moved from right tackle where he struggled as a rookie. And then he moved to backup. Now he's a left tackle. That's a lot to transition to. But the big concern I had was how tall he played. He was upright. And that's the kind of thing that as defenders see that more on film, they think of more and more ways to exploit that. And that happened over the course of that Panther game. And it's happened more each week. He's become more exposed as the exposure of him has grown. So that's one problem. Surles at the other side, or Cyrils at right tackle, is a problem. A journeyman backup, and then the fact that Jake Long got on the field
today.
And I'm not trying to. I don't mean to rip Jake Long. He's had a very nice career, but he had a very nice career. He was done. He was out of the league. And the fact that he got on the field at left tackle early in the game, gave up a strip sack fumble, and then remained on the field later where he could give up another one, that tells you how zero confidence that those coaches have right now in their other offensive tackles in Minnesota.
Yeah.
This is going to be a problem, Gary.
PFF had Jake Long for 13 snaps, I believe. And I'm assuming they only got Jake Long because Orlando Pace wouldn't return their calls.
Yeah.
But it was incredible to see Jake Long back out there. That makes no sense. He's been gone for too long. And he was done last time he was here 2 years ago. I guess the question now is, the Vikings don't, whatever, it's not a panic mode type of thing, but
no.
Joe Thomas is out there. The Browns have floated through Mike Florio, it sounds like. They're looking for a second rounder for Joe Thomas. You've already spent all those picks to get Sam Bradford. Would you pull the trigger on Joe Thomas?
For a second round, I'm giving up a second round pick if I'm doing
You're
this.
You're giving up a second round pick, but you've already given up your first and fourth.
The question, there's two parts to that question. One of it is just, is Joe Thomas worth that at this stage of his career? He still is very good. Like, you watch him on film, he looks the same as he's always looked. He has the best balance and recovery technique of any left tackle in the league, I believe. He's not super, I mean, he's 31 years old. He could conceivably play another 3 or 4 years at a high level.
Yeah.
So I think, yes, you do it for Joe Thomas for a second rounder. That's that one question. The other question, though, is the fact that you gave up your first and your fourth round pick, should that factor into your decision of whether you trade a second rounder for Thomas now? Are those mutually exclusive or are they related? And I think the initial thinking is, hey, those are related. You want to have some draft picks. But why wouldn't they be mutually exclusive? The idea of the draft is to get good players in spots that you need them. You need a left tackle badly. You can get one right here, right now, and you're not going to have any issues with Joe Thomas. You're not going to have to worry about him learning the scheme or something. He'll understand what's going on, and you can plug that in and solve your greatest weakness. I think you do that trade. I think you do it, and you consider, hey, that's how we spent our second-round pick, and we're going to get a Pro Bowl left tackle for 3 years out of it. That's probably what's the best you could hope for anyway if you use a second-rounder as a Pro Bowler for 3 years, but there's not going to be a Pro Bowler right away. Joe Thomas will be a Pro Bowler right away for you.
Yeah. No, I am in complete agreement. Once Jake Long was signed to your roster, you probably should have had some sirens going off in the building. Just a quick question on the quarterbacks. Any reason to worry about Bradford, who is uncharacteristically turnover prone today, or about Carson Wentz on the other side, who also certainly did not play well in this one?
Yeah, Wentz wasn't sharp in this one. I'm not worrying about him yet. I thought he looked good last week. He's not been what he was. The last three games had not been like his first three, but the foundation's still the same. I still think he's exactly what you want in a QB, and now we're just seeing a little bit of up and down from it. Bradford played out of a hole all game, and there was pressure on him, and he's handled that very well this season, to his credit. He's a better thrower of the ball than we remember with him. The mm-hmm. problem, the concern there is you have two parts there in Minnesota. You have your offensive line so bad you can't run the ball either. So
yeah.
You're going to be in third down and long situations in theory with a bad offensive line. That's why I think they have a real issue here, because they're not a good running team. They don't have a running back who can create yards now that Peterson's out. So you're dependent on the blocking in both your run game and your pass game, and your blocking is by far your biggest weakness.
Number three.
This is the Chargers over the Falcons in overtime. I will just say right now, this is the game of the year to this point when it comes to the aesthetics of it, the excitement of it, and the quality of play. This is the game that restored my faith in humanity. Phillip Rivers was wonderful. Matt Ryan was sharp as well. This was just great football, and I'm just glad to see things finally starting to break right a little bit for the Chargers. On top of Rivers playing well, they got some really big moments out of Melvin Gordon, who, every time we talk about Melvin Gordon, it's because he's lost another fumble at the worst possible time. But Gordon was excellent in this game, and I don't know. I think the Chargers have this thing turned around. I think they're going to be right there in that AFC West race as we head to the second half of the season.
Hot take, Gary, because at AFC West, everybody's 4-2 or better, I believe, aren't they?
Yeah, well, except for the Chargers. Right.
That's what made the take so hot. Here's one thing they do in San Diego extremely well. They do a few things well, but something that you notice each week, and there's actually two of them, and it's in their passing game. Shallow crossing routes are one of the things they do, and the other one is switch releases, meaning receivers crisscrossing off the line of scrimmage, the natural picks and rubs that you hear about. They do that very well, and they killed Denver with those a few nights ago. So though, and why I bring that up, those are both sustainable. That's not like a rhythm type of thing so much. That's an execution thing. That's what you do each week that can beat the predicted defense, especially if the defense is man-to-man coverage. And that builds inherent consistency into your passing game because they're not those create easy completions for Rivers.
Yeah. Yeah, and look, Tyrell Williams is the truth. He was excellent today. Again, he is just getting better and better. And like I said, Gordon played well. Falcons played great too. But, they're certainly in control in the NFC South, and I think they're going to be fine going forward. They didn't play that poorly defensively, I thought. They, just Phillip Rivers made some plays, outmaneuvered him in the end.
Number four.
Miami Dolphins, Jay Ajayi. 200 yards again. He joins O.J. Simpson, Earl Campbell, Ricky Williams as the only players to top 200 yards in consecutive games. Andy, I know you like this guy.
Why do you say that? Because he's from Boise State and I live in Boise?
That, and you have said in the past, I like this guy.
that's usually the giveaway. What's neat with Ajayi, what I like is when a guy is better than his body type suggests. And David Johnson's this way as well. I'll use Johnson because he's an easier guy to illustrate the point with, and I'll tell you what I mean with Ajayi. But David Johnson, if you look at him, he's high cut and thick. And you think, oh, at best he'll be a downhill roller, and maybe he's Eddie George, and he can be powerful by running upright. Maybe. Or chances are he'll be a guy you can tackle. And then David Johnson beats you with his lateral jump cut, and you have no idea what to do about that. That doesn't match up. He's better than his body type. Ajayi is a little bit like that as well. He can roll downhill, and he's going to be a tick faster than what you expect almost every single time. He can turn the corner. He's lighter on his feet than he appears. He's also an upright runner, so you wouldn't think that he would be an elusive guy. And he's not elusive in the purest sense, but he's like a better LeGarrette Blount, really, where he doesn't look like he should ever make anybody miss, and he can make you miss. He's a light foot, power-built type of runner. They have something there in him, I think. And I know, like, Greg Cosell, who I respect immensely as a draft analyst guy, as everything football guy, but especially with the draft, he was really high on Ajayi coming out. He saw those traits back in college. So it's a matter of whether they can feel comfortable with Ajayi with all the ancillary stuff. Blocking, passing game, off the field focus, where is he in that regard? But as a runner of the football, he's a good talent.
Well, he also, coming out of the draft, he was a fifth-round pick, but he was also a medicals guy, too. So
Yeah.
There was some talk, maybe you only get 4 or 5 good years out of him, but certainly
going to
be one
now,
of those good years. Yes, yes. But this is the one other thing I wanted to say about the Dolphins is, I don't know, Adam Gase has to have, like, the angel and the devil on his shoulder, and it's like the angel is winning out and telling him, just run the ball, stop throwing, and it's so against his nature. Because last week, I mean, look, they led most of the game against Pittsburgh. They were in control for the most part. It was 30-8 forever in that game. It ended up 30-15. They ended up controlling the ball for 36-30. They ran for 222. They were trailing for most of this game. I think they didn't take the lead until the fourth quarter. I'll bring up the box score just so I am actually speaking in factual statements here. And yeah, they were trailing going into the fourth, but they stuck with the run all game. They ended up running for 256. They controlled the clock for 37 minutes. They ran it 41 times. They threw it 25, which is just, that's not Adam Gase football, but it's winning football. And plus, they had two teams come down there to the Heat in Miami, and they just wore them down both times. They wore down the Bills today.
I've gotten to know Adam Gase pretty well. I've learned a lot from him. He's been great to me as just a guy who teaches football. And there are three things that are very true about him. One is, you're right, he does not like to run the ball. The second is, he's very smart. And the third is, he's very humble. He's confident, but he's humble. He's humble in his behavior.
Yeah.
So two out of three went out there. He's smart enough to know I have to run the ball, and he's humble enough to go ahead and do that. And here he is calling a running play 41 times out of about 66 snaps, I think you said it was. That's quite remarkable, because that absolutely goes against his nature. So hats off to him, credit to him. And look, they got their offensive line back together there in Miami too. When they were really struggling a few weeks ago, we didn't maybe put enough emphasis on the fact that they were playing Turner and Dallas Thomas on the left side, guys that really shouldn't have been on the field, frankly. And I understand their backups, they were forced in the lineup, but they'd had issues for several years. That's why they were backups. Those guys are gone. They're not even on the roster anymore. They've got Tunzel back. Tunzel, by the way, is as impressive as an athlete as anyone I've seen at left guard in the league this season and maybe in a few years. He's a big-time player. And Brandon Albert can still play at left tackle. Long arm, strong, understands balance. It's a whole different team when you have just those two guys stationed on the left side of your offensive line.
Yep. One more thing in that game. Ugly, ugly crackback block. Jarvis Landry on Aaron Williams. As ugly a play as you'll see in and the NFL this year, I would hope. Landry should be suspended for it. I don't know if you saw it yet, Andy, but
I haven't seen it yet.
I'm sure he won't be suspended for it because the outrage meter is just not high enough, and that's how these things happen. And one other thing, since you brought up David Johnson, going to be a guest on the Peter King podcast this week.
Oh, good for him. Good for Peter as well.
Not only a unique prospect, he's a triplet, you know.
I was about to just make a corny joke like, hey, did you know he's a triplet? Because everybody says that. I was going to be sarcastic about it, but Peter will probably lead off with that and get him to say something that he's never said to anyone before about being a triplet, too.
There you go. Peter King, not a triplet.
Peter
but he
gets right to it on that stuff. He'll know what to do.
You'll have to check that out, MMQB Podcast with Peter King.
Number five.
As for this podcast, let's go on to topic number five, which was the Patriots go down to Pittsburgh and beat the Steelers. This was, Roethlisberger out, Landry in. I know you had a close eye on this game, Andy. I sort of had it on the side as I watched the wonderful Falcons-Chargers game, but I'll let you weigh in on what you saw today.
This is an easy one. This was a quintessential Patriots performance. So let's start on the defense for a change. That's a bend but don't break defense, and they forced Pittsburgh into a lot of field goals. And we always think of New England as they do everything, they do all these different game plans each week on defense. That hasn't been true in 10 or 12 years. They did that back when they had Teddy Bruschi and Willie McGinnis and Mike Vrabel and Ted Johnson and Lawyer Malloy or Rodney Harrison, a bunch of veterans. But they're more of an athletic-driven defense now. They play man coverage. They just try to out-execute you, not try to out-scheme you, and that's what they did against Pittsburgh. They were very good at it once again. And then on offense, it's about dictating matchups in the middle of the field. And they were making a big deal about that Gronkowski and Bennett weren't huge factors in the first half of the game, but that's not the nature of facing the Steelers for New England. The Steelers are a zone-based nickel defense. They're always going to, almost always, they do play more dime than they used to, but for the most part, they're going to have two linebackers on the field. They're going to have at least one with significant coverage responsibilities, usually Lawrence Timmons, and the Patriots felt they could spread out, put Edelman inside, and isolate Edelman on Timmons in space against the predicted zone coverages, and that's exactly what they did. That's how New England plays. They find they dictate the matchups. Timmons is a great linebacker. Edelman's a great receiver. Receiver wins in the passing game every time in that scenario. So it was a straightforward approach. It's exactly what you'd expect from New England. They're also using their running backs very well, Blunt on the ground game, and White in the passing game as a complementary player to those tight ends. It's fun watching the Patriots offense. I like seeing where everybody lines up each play. It's always going to be a different spot, it feels like.
There you go. I have nothing to add in this game. I was bummed to see Cameron Hayward didn't play, just because I like Cameron Hayward. But, that was about it.
Hargrave's been pretty good filling in for Hayward, by the way.
Yeah.
But I mean, he's not Hayward. I'm not saying that.
Exactly.
They want all those guys in the field together because they play a little bit of different positions. But Hargrave in their nickel has filled the Hayward role. And there's really only one other nose tackle in the league I can think of who has played in sub packages this season and been really effective. And that's Vince Wilfork for Houston.
Okay. A likable guy.
Now you wished you'd watch the game.
I don't. I honestly was so...
You were so I get it. You're just smitten with that Charger Falcons. I'll watch the Charger Falcons film, And I'll send you my notes first thing tomorrow night when I get a chance to look at it.
When,
I promise
when
you
Falcons
that.
Chargers ended, I was just full of the Christmas spirit. That's how I would put it.
Yeah. No, I get it. I felt that way after the Sunday night game, the fist fight in Phoenix or in Glendale.
But it ruined so many fantasy games, Andy. You don't understand.
Probably ruined more than that. Was that what was the Vegas line in that?
It was actually really close. It was I think it ended up being Seattle was getting a point. So Seattle covered.
All right. There you go.
Not that I follow that kind of thing.
No, that's good. Gambling and fantasy are why we have listeners. I'm not unaware of that. I don't do either, but I fully appreciate all of it. I feel like a dealer to those people.
Speaking of which, hold that next thought, Andy. We are in mid-season. You probably have your fantasy leagues going. You have your pick'em pools, and that's all well and good. But maybe you make things a little more interesting going forward. Get in the action and play like the pros at MyBookie.net. It's the most exciting online experience for sports fans. MyBookie features real Vegas odds and incredible player props on every football game. Did the game already kick off? That's all right. MyBookie has live in-games with odds updated in real time. So maybe you want to put a little money down that the kicker is going to miss a 19-yard field goal at the end of overtime and the game's going to end in a tie. You could probably make some pretty good cash off of that. It is never too late to make a play, and it is optimized for smartphone users for nonstop action on the go. Go online, type MyBookie in your browser, and sign up today. Use the promo code 10THINGS, that's 10THINGS, to be entered into their $1 million prize pool, or call 844-722-2387. Join the thousands of online players already playing, only the biggest, only the best, only at MyBookie. Sign up today.
This is Adrian Wojnarowski of The Vertical. For candid conversations with the biggest names around the NBA, be sure to check out our podcast network, which includes The Vertical Podcast with Woj, The Vertical Podcast with JJ Redick, and The Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix, all at thevertical.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Number six.
All right, on to topic six. This is the London game. This is the garbage we keep shipping out to the United Kingdom, and it's going to be a diplomatic issue after a while.
Oh, they're eating it up out there. They love it. They're grateful. They appreciate it. They probably wish we'd sent them our 3-3 tie, our 6-6 tie, so they could have related a little better, seen some missed kicks. But
I was going to say, I feel like if you watch, you know, for the fans out there who are watching the NFL regularly, This has to be such a bummer to see these just crap games. Over on Twitter, Nick Rimmer at NickRimmer36 wrote to us and just, you know, in the afternoon said, presumably number one on the 10 Things podcast will be the awful standard of play in the London games and early U.S. games. So this is this was not a beautiful game. This was a lot of Case Keenum interceptions. Sounds like who was it? Kenny Britt or Brian Quick? It was Brian Quick on the last play, right?
Yeah, it was Brian Quick, and he and Keenum were not on the same page on that one. And I'd like to know. There's an answer to that. Somebody was right and somebody was wrong.
What was that? Giants, was that zero blitz on that last play?
I believe it was zero blitz. You always have to be. Yeah, it was zero blitz. And the Giants have had success with blitzes the last couple of weeks too. They've done a good job. They'll blitz you on second down, not just third down. And Landon Collins has been an important player for them, not just because he's getting interceptions. He had two in this game, but he's also been an effective blitzer in their packages. Yeah. And he's been a good downhill hitter, too. He's turning into a nice player because he has some limitations in coverage that you have to hide. He's not a man coverage defender, and he'll miss a tackle once in a while. So if you said you have a safety who can't cover man-to-man and he misses tackles, you'd say that's not a safety you'd want. But they've found a way to make him a viable, important piece in their defense still.
He does. I always thought Landon Collins would be a liability in that defense because he does have so many limitations in coverage, but he has become a nice player. And by the way, excellent run back. Not only an entertaining run back for the touchdown off of that first tipped interception, but the Giants have been so bad in the red zone. You really have to think that's a 4-point play there, Collins getting that to the end zone. Because I don't know. The way the Giants go down there, you know, you figure you're settling for a chip shot attempt. little Robbie Gould action. But, you know, the big storyline here, Keenum throws the 4 interceptions. Not all his fault, except Keenum seems to have a throw or two every week that doesn't get intercepted where you say, whoa, terrible throw that should have been intercepted. So the question now is it time for Goff? I know you did some study with Goff leading up to the draft last year. Do you think he'd be on schedule to get onto the field at this point, or do you just call this a redshirt year for him and just keep on going forward with Case Keenum?
I can't answer that because what he's asked to do in Los Angeles, those offenses are so different than from Cal. So I don't know where Goff is in the process. And remember, Goff he played 3 years in college. Dak Prescott and Carson Wentz, they were 5-year guys. So Goff comes into the league 2 years behind them and also played in a system that was much less conducive to transfer into the NFL than those other two rookies. So it's unfortunate for him because it's looking like, oh, Goff's not well, he's already a bust. He can't get it together. It's not an apples-to-apples scenario. And I don't know what they would ask him to do. My sense is I think you have to stick with Keenum because – you don't have any talent around him in Los Angeles there. Todd Gurley is great, but there's nothing going in the running game this year because the offensive line can't win, and there are receivers who really don't scare people. So you have to win through play design if that's the case. And if it's about winning through play design, then you have no choice but to go with the more experienced, at this point, smarter, if you will, smarter quarterback. And Keenum, for all his flaws, and he's got a lot of them, he is a very inconsistent thrower. At times he's an inconsistent decision maker, but really it's that he's just not a good enough thrower of the football, accuracy or arm strength. Despite all that, he still gives you the chance to run your offense. And that's a very well put together offense. It's getting better each week. Their game against the Lions was one of the best I've seen on film all year in terms of winning through play designs. And I thought they did some nice things on first down against the Giants. They're very good at beating you on first down play calls where the defense becomes predictable. I think you have to do Keenum for that, though. I don't think Goff gives you the full dimension of that, and there's nobody around Goff to help him out if he were in there.
All right. Now, I have no problem with Goff sitting, and certainly they would know where he is better than we do. I think when you rush a guy out there too early, you risk creating bad habits that, I mean, look, once you get out there onto the field, you can make mistakes in practice that you wouldn't make on the field in a live game situation when you're trying not to embarrass yourself and you sort of fall back into things that you shouldn't do that aren't good for the long term. That was a very vague answer I just gave.
No, you're right, Gary, and that's one way people think of it. Keep in mind, from Los Angeles' perspective, they're saying, hey, we're 3-4. That's not an awful record in the NFL. It's still relatively early. We got more than half our games left. We could be 5-2. We've been in some close ones the last 2 weeks, and we felt like we were the better team in both of those, I imagine. We're going to play the guy who's best right now. We're a professional football team. We're not thinking about the long-term development of one guy, even though it happens to be our future franchise QB. We've got 52 other players on the roster who are wanting to win games, and so that's how they're viewing it, is what's happening here and now. And Keenum's, to them, is the answer for right here, right now, regardless of Goff's mental health long-term as a QB who gets rushed in there or not.
I'd worry about breaking my fragile number one overall pick.
Well, fragile. Look, remember, keep in mind, too, Goff got thrown to the Wolves in Cal, and he came out as a better QB for it, too.
He did. He did. That's true. My favorite play from this game. One last thing on this terrible, terrible game. It was a terrible game, and please, any listeners over the UK, accept my apology on behalf of the United States of America.
Oh, but come on. This game was not that bad. You're acting like this was one of the Thursday night games from this year.
The Thursday night game, that's not even NFL football anymore. That's a pile of garbage that they just throw out there because people will pay them money for it. But there was a 3rd-and-3 play from like the 30-yard line of the Rams for the Giants. And every time I watch the Giants, I'm like, you know what? This offense is so painful to watch. Whatever happens on this play, just throw a jump ball to Odell Beckham and just let him make a play. And they did it. They finally did it, and Beckham actually came down. He caught it with two hands for once and came down with a 22-yard catch, set up a touchdown for him. That was the only play I enjoyed during that entire game.
Yeah, and that was another switch release, too. The Rams defended that very well, and that's the unfortunate part. That's the Odell Beckham factor. That's the difference between the Giants and Rams, because the Rams, yep, that's, the concept should have won. It was third down and three, third and four, something like that. The Giants had the right kind of play call. They actually helped their receivers with a man beater, which is not in their system typically, not a huge part of it. And the man beater didn't work, and Beckham won anyway. I'm with you. That was an intriguing play.
Yep. And we'll have a discussion. There's another London game next week. There's more London games next week,
really?
I guess we can maybe make up for it.
There's I get assigned to them early, and so I got to who's playing next week?
Washington, Cincinnati. So we'll talk about it next week. And I have solutions to fix these London games and to fix Thursday Night Football, but we'll get into it another time.
Number seven.
So we'll jump ahead to topic seven, which is the Cleveland Browns still winless. So the 72 Dolphins got to break out their champagne toast. Browns are still winless, which means the 2008 Detroit Lions will have to hold off on their toast, which I assume is human tears. But the Cavs are NBA champions. The Indians are going to the World Series. The Browns just still can't catch a break. They're down to Kevin Hogan now, who you will not like him as a quarterback. I don't know if you saw anything today, Andy, but he comes from a pro-style system at Stanford, so there was some like, oh, well, he's a little more pro-ready. But Hogan was always a sort of one-look, pull-it-down-and-run type of guy at Stanford, and that's what he did today. He ran a lot. He ran a ton. He ran for 100-something yards.
Oh,
but,
did he?
This was a game where the Browns were overmatched by the Bengals.
Well, the Bengals are his own defense, so if you're running a lot against them, it means you're probably not reading the field well, because typically QBs run against man coverage because man defenders run away from the QB following the wide receiver that they're guarding, and that's how lanes open up. So yeah. I look forward to watching this film. I'll get through this one in about an hour and a half, I bet. That'll be good.
I'd be curious. I had very little... I had very little will to really watch this game closely. But Hogan rushed seven times for 104 yards and a touchdown. And he threw for 100 on 24 throws. So that's the kind of quarterback you're going to see, Andy, when you break down this film. But Browns are – I don't know. Are the Browns realistically – are they going to go winless? I think they're all right. I think they're going to win one or two this year.
Yeah, no, I don't – they're not atrocious. Every game I've seen, which is all – I think it's all of them – They've been competitive in the game, and I mean that like in the way that they've looked like a professional football team. They have an offense, they have things they do on defense that work sometimes, it doesn't work all the other times or every time. They just don't have talent in the right places yet, which is to be fully expected. They utterly overhauled their offense this year. They'll probably have half new players again next season. That's just where the Browns are at in their process right now. But they're not doing a bad job there. And this isn't an embarrassment. It's a team with a really bad record is all.
Yes. Better days ahead.
Number eight.
Topic eight. The reader response topic. We're still working on the title, but we'll call it Reader Response this week. The original idea was that I was going to give out my home telephone number and have all of you call me at 1 a.m. Monday morning, but we scrapped that and instead reached out for some stuff on Twitter and Facebook at Andy_Benoit or at GGrambling_SI if you want to get in on this. Couple questions this week. Let's start with at LJ_Sherman, I believe it is. Winston and Mariota. Jameis Winston and Marcus Mariota, are they progressing, Andy?
That's a good question. I love that question. I think Winston has been much more erratic than the Bucs would hope. Some of that I still think can be, if you want to look at the silver lining, the reason he's erratic is because he tries to read the field like a veteran, so he takes on that responsibility, and he sometimes is wrong. But yeah, it's not like he can't read the field. It's that he plays aggressive, and he does make some big time throws, and he's willing to fit balls into tight windows, and he's not good enough to be that way every single down yet. But the foundation is still there, so I think they would hope he'd be a little further along just this season. But the Bucs still have a good QB there. As far as Mariota, he's actually taken a little bit of a step back as well, just in this regard. he hasn't been as accurate this season, Gary, and his mechanics.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's the case or what the deal is. I still don't think he fits that offense fully. Now, to Mark Mularkey's credit, though, that offense has evolved the last few weeks. Early in the season, I said I don't think Mariota fits it at all. It's an old school 22 personnel, two backs, two tight ends. We're going to run the ball for 3 yards every play, and that's how we're going to win. They've totally evolved from that now. They're more diverse with their route concepts, or throwing on first down and having success. Mariota's been good out of spread sets at the end of halves. So there's an upside with that, but Mariota as a pure in a vacuum quarterback has not been as fine-tuned this season as he was a year ago. And my guess would be it's because he's adjusting to a system. He's adjusting to a new system under Mularkey. Mularkey doesn't do what Ken Whisenhunt did with Mariota early last season.
Yeah. Can I just make one point about Jameis?
Yeah.
I don't know why I'm asking permission, because I'm just going to make a point about Jameis.
Yeah, I have no choice.
Yeah. I think the schedule. I think the schedule really affected. You know, they've had to face Denver. I think he's been overwhelmed by some pass rushes. I think they, you know, with Vincent Jackson hampered and now out, I think they've been working through some things. I think he's going to have a big second half.
And that Vincent Jackson one hurts too. That Vincent Jackson one hurts. And they won today in San Francisco, to their credit. So,
yep.
Vincent Jackson, they don't have someone on the roster to replace him.
I was going to say, it's not even a matter of, I mean, they don't have someone that size, that style,
right,
to replace him. They're not deep anyway. They don't even have a good smaller guy to throw out there. They're in some trouble. Russell Shepard, the old LSU guy I saw was out there today, caught a touchdown. So maybe he's an answer. But next question comes from Alberto Garcia at DRF0711. Very pessimistic question. As the Steelers drop to 4-3, there is still no statement win. Should we worry that Coach Tomlin consistently gets outcoached?
As I understand it, they've played 7 games, they've won 4. So I count 4 statement wins there. And they also they won a Super Bowl too. So if you have a higher threshold for a statement win, you can go to that one from, granted, years ago. But I don't know what this question's asking, quite frankly, Gary.
Do you
guy listening. I do. I appreciate it. But
yeah.
This is not a good question.
Do you think the Steelers get outcoached?
No. No.
Okay. I don't think so either.
You almost never watch the NFL and say, oh, this team flat out outcoached that team, which is how you'd have to declare that in order to actually brand something as outcoaching, because that's a harsh label. And no, they don't get outcoached. No, absolutely not.
I'll say this, and as I've said before, I am from a family of Steelers fans. The Steelers lay an egg once or twice a year.
Yeah, they do.
And they've already done it twice this year. And it's just, it's always confusing because they almost always bounce back. This week was a little bit different because obviously Roethlisberger was out. But, you know, I think it was something like they had won 10 of their last 11 after a loss in the regular season or something like that before today. But, you know, this is a team that has some baffling losses every now and then. Today was not really one of them. Today they played a really good team that beat them.
Good. Very good. Are we out of reader things, or we have one more before we do this lightning round?
No, we have polls. We have quick polls to recap here. You can vote on polls if you follow me or follow Andy on Twitter. We had last week's post-show poll was, how do you think the 1-5 Panthers will end up this year? They did not give up a single point this week. 61% of you said not close to playoff contention. 34% said they would narrowly miss the playoffs, 4% said they would get a wild card spot, and 1% said they would be NFC South champions. Andy, do you have anything to add to that?
Just that they didn't give up the point because they didn't play bye week. Nice job with that, though. I see what
We had this week's pre-show poll, which I guess we'll do that going forward. Which sub-500 AFC team has the best chance to make the playoffs? Bengals 48%, Chargers 34%, Dolphins 10%, Ravens 8%. We had a handful of write-ins for the Colts, basically as the AFC South. I don't know. I still think they might relegate the AFC South at some point, so I didn't put them in this poll. But I would have voted Chargers here because now I'm just totally on the Chargers bandwagon.
Yeah, I would have put the Colts in the poll to begin with.
You can only fit four, though.
I still want to put them in.
Probably should have cut the Ravens or the Dolphins, but whatever.
Okay.
And our last poll of the week, Andy. This was based on our text gate last week. Keeping in mind that you asked me a question via text was the text I sent back to you saying that it was a pretty short OT in the Sunday night game. This was Texans Colts.
No, hold on. I did not ask you a question.
You did. You did ask a question.
I said I'm starting the OT. This is the Texans Colts game now. I said I'm starting the OT. I will call you. We'll do the show as soon as it's done. Is that okay? If I asked a question,
yes,
is that
okay?
Yes,
that's a question, though.
And your answer was pretty short overtime, which I took as a spoiler. So we can get to the poll, but I will say this, to your credit, because we had another overtime. You were challenged immediately the next week, and I'll just read the text. I wrote to you, I have 9.5 minutes left in regulation. Now, I didn't know at that time. I had almost another half a game to go. I said, it'll probably end 5 minutes late for me on our starting time. Sorry to be running a few minutes late. It won't happen again. It'll probably happen again. And then your response was, I acknowledge your message and look forward to later interactions. And that was excellent.
Yeah.
That was a perfect response. I didn't read it because I didn't trust it and I didn't want to look at it. But after the game, I saw your response. It was good. Anyway, so what's the poll? Did anyone else, did anybody think you didn't potentially spoil the Texans-Colts game for me last week?
It was 56% said bad text, 44% said good text. So I learned a lesson here, and that lesson is that democracy does not work. And we have a very uneducated base of voters here on our show.
You improved.
So there
this
you
week.
Go.
I'll give you that. I'm not. You improved. You did learn. You did learn, whether you want to admit it or not.
Number nine.
Let's go on to the lightning round. Topic nine, the lightning round. We'll start with Washington and Detroit. Matthew Stafford does it again. He is carrying this team on his own. One other thing before I let you chime in on this. Kirk Cousins kept it on a zone read play and ran it for a touchdown. It was it was like turn back the clock to RG3 in that game.
Yeah. Cousins is more mobile than people realize. He's not mobile, but he's more mobile than you think. Stafford's actually very mobile as well. And Stafford can do two things that are conducive to coming from behind. I'm not saying that's exactly what he did in this game, but just conceptually, because he's had a lot of come-from-behind wins in his career. He can move with his feet. He can make plays with his feet and buy time and make weird throws off of movement. That's one. And the other is he's a very good tight window thrower, especially to the sidelines. And why that's important is because that's how you beat cover two, and cover two is almost always the coverage teams play when they're protecting a lead late in games.
Yeah. And look, he made a comeback. Stafford came back and topped that comeback. The Redskins, Matt Jones, lost a bad fumble early on. They had two turnovers. That's how this game turned on them. They let this one get away from them. Let's go on to Colts and Titans. Nice comeback win for the Colts. Spread ended up being a little bit bigger because they tacked on a defensive touchdown at the end, but this was an Andrew Luck comeback, and I thought it was nice to see the Colts put Frank Gore on the field late in the game instead of going to that spread crap where, and not to bust on Josh Ferguson, but you got to
stop putting Josh Ferguson
on the field.
I haven't been huge on Josh Ferguson this year myself. I don't quite see I understand his role on the team. I don't quite see the appeal, so I'm with you on the Frank Gore thing. They've had some comeback wins against the Titans over the years. Andrew Luck, similar to Stafford, another guy that can move around. He'll make tight window throws. And in this case, he was facing a defense that he's seen before. Not an easy defense to play against, though. The Titans do a lot of different things, and they've added a lot more of man coverage to their repertoire as well. So this is a nice little win for the Colts, and they did it on the road.
Yeah. I mean, it's an AFC South win, so put the asterisk on it. But win's a win as far as the standings go. Chiefs keep on going. Chiefs are getting hot again. They beat the Saints. They really were in complete control of this game. I don't know. Are we going to see another big win streak from KC at this point, Andy?
They're capable of it. That's probably the best all-around screen team in the NFL, system-wise. Running backs, tight ends, wide receivers. They manufacture offense. They win through their play designs to find the reads for Alex Smith. That's as good and strong and well-designed offense as anything you'll see in the NFL.
All right, we're getting into the sad part of the lightning round. Let's go Ravens, Jets. Geno Smith gets on the field and gets hurt pretty soon after. He threw like 8 throws, a couple of bad drops. Quincy Enunwa made a pretty routine play into a long touchdown. Really tough to get a read on. Geno Smith throws the ball well. I think we knew that before, though, but one other thing from that game. Jets topped the Ravens, by the way. Marty Mornhinweg, who my impression was he was supposed to come in and he was going to reestablish the run game, you know, that the Ravens were going to get back to running the ball, Ravens football. They were not trailing by more than a possession at any point during this game. They were leading for a large chunk of it. 44 throws, 10 handoffs a day for Joe Flacco. It was a really bad game to watch. I watched the entire thing, and I don't know. I don't know what the Ravens are doing. They are a mess. Flacco actually played well for the first half, and then it all just fell apart in the second half.
It's 4 straight losses now for the Ravens, so it's getting serious. These were the second one in a row at New York, too, as to the Giants last week. They lost late to Odell Beckham. The only thing I can think of is there are teams that don't feel comfortable running against the Jets' defensive front. That's a great defensive line. Not everybody matches up well to that line. So there have been other teams that said, we're not going to bother running against the Jets. And the Jets' pass defense ranks near the bottom of the league this year. So maybe that had something to do with it. But you're right. Mornhinweg was supposed to – the reason he's calling plays now and Trestman's gone is they want more balance. I think it's two things. They want more balance from the running game. Also, I don't think Trestman's passing game was working quite the way they were hoping it would in Baltimore. It did not look great. And I'm not blaming Trestman necessarily either. It's someone has to be a fall guy at times for this stuff, but it's felt very fragmented all season long watching their film.
Yes. And look, last thing I'll say about that offense is the throws were not open today. I mean, this was Joe Flacco fitting in a lot of nice throws early on, and then when things crumbled in the second half, they turned into turnovers. This was not a good look for the Ravens. Tampa goes out to San Francisco, gets back on track, gets a win coming off that bye week. I guess they won before the bye week. They just won ugly against Carolina, but they were in control in this one. Jameis looked better. The numbers are better. Colin Kaepernick still not really getting it done for the Niners, who jumped out early, and then, you know, this just sort of looked like a Niners game after that.
And Niners are they're in the same thing as the Browns, same boat. It's a total overhaul rebuilding thing. I don't say you don't give them a pass for losing, but let's not worry too much. They're sorting things out there. It's going to take a little bit of time.
Yeah. And lastly, the Jaguars making everyone incredibly sad. This team is not going in the right direction. Raiders in total control against the Jaguars today. One play I will highlight, and then I'll ask you what you think of Blake Bortles. But there is Marquette King. It was 4th and 24, and the Raiders were punting. And Marquette King bobbled the snap and couldn't get the kickoff. And he ran for 27 yards untouched. It was ridiculous. It was the most Jaguars-y play I have seen. and it's just such a bummer to see the Jaguars, who, you know, they were slowly rising, and they've just sort of fallen off a precipice at this point.
And as far as Bortles, I'll need to see the film on this one. I will say this, though. Oakland has won 4 times now on the road. This was another early window game in the East Coast. This is incredible.
Yeah.
You're not supposed to be able to win those games.
Exactly.
West Coast going to East Coast, 10 a.m. Start time in their body clocks.
Good for Jack Del Rio. Good for the Raiders. Marquette King outrushes T.J. Yeldon today. That's also driving me nuts. That's something else I want to hear from you about, that T.J. Yeldon's not getting enough playing time or touches. They don't run the ball either. Yeah. Jaguars are making me sad. Let's move on to Topic 10, awards time.
Number 10.
Andy, do you want to start off Offensive Player of the Week, or do you want me to?
Yeah, I'll go. I'm giving it to David Johnson of the Cardinals. Numbers were not huge. They actually didn't even wind up winning the game. Nobody won the game. He's the reason they were in the game, though. Just the nature of it. Sometimes you get in those slugfests, and he converted a number of third and really shorts, 3rd and 2, 3rd and 3, which are not easy against that Seahawks defense. He was sustainable, kept them moving. It was a big part of their passing game, as usual. And they put a lot of different guys on him, too, in man coverage. At one point, they had Earl Thomas on him in man coverage. He also saw Wagner. He saw K.J. Wright. talented players he went up against, and he was a man tonight. He kept them in that one.
Yep. And learn all sorts of things about David Johnson on this week's MMQB podcast with Peter King. My offensive player of the week is Matthew Stafford, just standing on his head. They have no running backs left. They have basically Marvin Jones and Golden Tate. Eric Ebron is out, and Stafford makes it happen again. Making plays. He's awesome. That's all I got on Matthew Stafford. Defensive player of the week.
I'm going Cliff Averill, although maybe I need to give it to DJ Humphreys in this game, because Averill had a field day against him. He was a monster. Cliff Averill is such a good player with leverage, technique, and then speed to power or power to speed. He transitions very well into his moves. He's an excellent pass rusher.
I'm giving it to Denzel Perryman in my favorite game of the year. He was playing banged up the entire game. He dropped into zone coverage at one point and fooled Matt Ryan, ended up stepping in front of Julio Jones for a big interception during that comeback. And then he knifed through and got the fourth down stop in Falcons territory in overtime, which is a perfectly fine call, by the way, by Dan Quinn. The Falcons did the right thing. Perryman just made a play, and then I think he's going to run back to San Diego and build a stadium by himself because he was that good today. Special teams player of the week. So much special teams. It was all – the special teams were very special this week, Andy, so I can't wait to hear who you have here.
I'm going to go Marquette King. I don't know if you saw, Gary. There was a 4th-and-24 play at Jacksonville, and Marquette King got the ball, actually bobbled the snap, fumbled it a little bit, and then picked it up and ran untouched for 27 yards, outrushing T.J. Yeldon today in Jacksonville. A great play by Marquette King, a very special teams play. He's my special teams player of the week.
Did he go right sideline or left sideline?
Who's your special teams player of the week, Gary?
I'm giving it to Bobby Wagner, because he blocked a field goal with his armpit, which won it automatically at that point. And he actually won yours, too. We're taking it back for Marquette King, and we're going to send it to Bobby Wagner. He will get the Arby's gift card or whatever we give out for that. Or the MyBookie. Go to MyBookie, code 10things, $1 million.
I don't think Bobby Wagner's with all due my bookie's a great product. Bobby Wagner probably doesn't want to receive the gift from them on that one. That would just complicate things for him based on just the rules he plays under.
And coach of the week, Andy, who you got?
My coach of the week. Oh boy. How about Philadelphia and Jim Schwartz and what they did to that Vikings offense? I know they had an advantage. Yeah. Up front, and they took advantage of that. But Schwartz also dialed up some blitzes in the game, nickel star blitzes, meaning he blitzed his slot guy as well as an inside linebacker, and that's not been in his repertoire this year. He knows how to do them, of course. That's just not the way they played in Philly, but I think they wanted to protect their corners a little bit. I think they were smelling some blood in the water as far as their pass rush in Minnesota reacting to it. Those Viking running backs struggled in pass pro today. I'm going Jim Schwartz, Philadelphia's defensive coordinator.
I'm giving it to Adam Gase because, as we said before, this is crushing his soul to run the ball this often, but he's doing it, and they're winning games all of a sudden in Miami. All right, Andy, that's going to do it for this week. That is a show. Thank you, as always, to our researcher, Jeff Irwin, and to the folks at Digital Media who always make us sound so good. And thank you for listening to this episode of the MMQB 10 Things podcast. You guys really are the best. As always, you can reach out to Andy or me on Twitter, Andy_Benoit or GGrambling_SI, or on Facebook. We're both there. Just look us up. We love hearing from you. We also like to thank our sponsor, MyBookie.net. Please, please, please support them the way they support our show. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer, the MMQB podcast with Peter King, and this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys next week.
This has been a Digital Media production. Find your voice.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.